Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, a guilty verdict in the biggest municipal fraud case in city history. We talk with Florida Times Union Metro columnist Nate Monroe about what this historic moment means. Later, what a $145 million infusion means for the future of the Emerald Trail. We get reactions from four key stakeholders. But first, the former chief executive of the city's water and electric utility faces up to 25 years in federal prison. A jury convicted Aaron Zahn late Friday of conspiracy and wire fraud for his scheme to skim millions off of the sale of JEA. I'm joined by Nate Monroe, who has been reporting on the doomed and dubious privatization effort from the beginning. Good morning, Nate.
Good morning, Ann.
So, Nate, how consequential is this verdict and how much of a surprise?
I mean, look, you said this at the outset of the segment. This was a historic trial. You can look at it in terms of dollars and cents, the amount of money that was kind of the object of the conspiracy here, hundreds of millions of dollars. You can look at the fact that there were two juries presiding over this single trial, which is a very unusual setup. You can look at the length of the trial. It was about a month to the day after jury selection began. And you can consider the fact that this trial was about corruption at the highest levels of our most important city agency. I mean, JEA is the source of our drinking water, of our power. JEA is the reason we can flush the toilet. These are the means of modern life in a developed world. And so, it is historic by any measure you might take. I certainly believed the case that the prosecutors put together over the course of many years was very strong, that the CEO and the CFO, essentially deceived the board of directors in an effort to enrich themselves. I also thought that case would be enormously difficult to convince a jury to convict these guys. These convictions require a high level of scrutiny and proof, and But they got there with both charges against the CEO, and I was surprised by that. I mean, that is a profound outcome in this case.
So the jury convicted Aaron Zahn, but not the chief financial officer, Ryan Wanamaker. That was a little surprising because I believe you've pointed this out. They only had to find him guilty of one of 22 so-called overt acts in the conspiracy. And some of those weren't even disputed in terms of actions like he presented the plan to the board of directors. Why do you think the jury didn't convict?
I mean, look, trying to read into secret jury deliberations is a little bit difficult, and we have not as of yet actually heard from any of these jurors. It was, I think, self-evident. It took the Ryan Wanamaker jury about 2 days to come back with a verdict, and they came back really at sort of the last moment on Friday before this was going to extend into today. And so I think it's self-evident that there was some strong disagreement within the jury about conviction on Ryan Wanamaker. And it felt like, this is just sort of my read on the situation. It just sort of felt like that jury kind of ran the clock out. I don't think anybody wanted to come back on Monday and pick up deliberations again. And so I think, there were two pretty entrenched sides there, and the side that said not to convict won. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty obvious.
This is one of those kind of emperor's new clothes scenarios, I think, when in retrospect, it looks impossible to believe that it happened, that it came so close to happening. And that this near-done deal ended up with indictments and a federal court conviction.
Yes. I mean, I'd forgotten about this very live controversy back in 2019. And one of the things that I certainly revisited as the government was unspooling its case in front of the jury was exactly that point, how close this came to actually happening. I mean, Florida Power and Light had a draft purchase and sale agreement in hand for JEA. I mean, they were hammering out, I mean, really really moving fast toward closing a transaction with some bidder. And you know, to go back and remember, we were being told at the time that this was just an exploration exercise, that this wasn't really happening. We weren't really selling the utility. That's not what the board voted for. And yet this is what's happening. And part of what was kind of funny about the trial is Aaron Zahn's defense strategy was to basically relitigate that all over again. I mean, in that courtroom, we were back to arguing whether he was really trying to sell JEA. And of course he was. I mean, there was a draft purchase and sale agreement to acquire JEA in the hands of private bidders. That can only be an effort to sell JEA. So it was in some ways kind of like stepping backwards in time, being in that courtroom. But yeah, I mean, this came very close to happening. This case, you know, I know some people are frustrated that the feds indicted a pretty narrow case at the end of the day against the CEO and the CFO of JEA. There were no politicians like the mayor involved in the indictment and didn't make any appearance during the trial. But this was a hard case for prosecutors to make by itself. And it's kind of remarkable that they did it. I mean, I think a lot of prosecutors might have written this off as a political parochial controversy. But I think a very determined federal prosecutor here really felt like something wrong happened and pursued this case for many, many years.
It may seem like kind of obvious to ask about lessons learned. I mean, you know, there were a lot of, you know, big lessons, I guess, that we took from it. But is there anything in terms of watchdogging city government that you think people should take away from this lesson?
And certainly, I think a big one is that we have these volunteer boards that are supposed to oversee these very important city agencies. And I do think none of these board members were accused of doing anything wrong. And in fact, I mean, the allegation is that they were misled. And I think there is truth to that. Having said that, I also feel like I felt in real time and I still feel today like the JEA board was certainly guilty of being incurious and lazy and kind of politically compromised. And they weren't scrutinizing everything the way they should have been. They were not as interested in kind of finding the truth out about the state of the utility industry. I mean, they were just not serious in their jobs. And I think that we need to really think hard about this system that we have with these volunteer boards. And we need to make sure that the people being appointed to these boards are serious about the work and that they're not just going to kind of go with the flow or accept what the, you know, the CEO and management's telling them, you know, sort of uncritically. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are tough jobs. And I think it's something that, you know, even if we wanted to rethink maybe how these agencies are overseen, I mean, I wouldn't even think that's a terrible idea. But I do think a lot of it begins right there.
Nate, you took a lot of heat, including from the former mayoral administration, during your years of reporting on this issue. Is there any sense of vindication personally that this ended with a proven crime?
I mean, I feel like the work always spoke for itself. And I came into this trial very confident about the work that we had done, what it showed, and I didn't feel like a conviction would have changed that. You know, I think it's good that, you know, if you take a pool of Jacksonville residents who had very limited knowledge about all of this controversy over time, and the government presented this narrative that matched a lot of what our reporting was, and they apparently decided that was compelling enough to convict somebody. I mean, certainly there is some, you know, I don't know if I'd call it vindication, but it does feel like it confirms, you know, the power of that narrative. But I never felt like a conviction was something that was necessary to kind of vindicate our work. I always thought it spoke for itself.
Well, Nate, I know I speak for a majority of people in Jacksonville, including JEA employees, city council, federal prosecutors, when I say thank you for all your deep and determined reporting on this issue.
Well, thank you, Anne. That's very nice.
Stick around. We'll be right back with how federal dollars will help complete the city's Emerald Trail. A planned 30-mile greenway connecting the city's urban neighborhoods and linking them to downtown and local waterways, and a new infusion of federal dollars moves it closer to reality. To discuss the news about the Emerald Trail, I'm joined by Kay Ehouse, CEO of Groundwork Jacksonville. That's the nonprofit in charge of designing the greenway. Hey, Kay.
Hello, Anne.
Hello. Close call. We actually do have Melissa Ross, a name you'll all recognize as this program's former host, now serving as the city of Jacksonville's Director of Strategic Initiatives. Hey, Melissa, good morning.
Hi, Anne. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Also joined by Greer Gillis, Senior Vice President and Chief Infrastructure and Development Officer at the Jacksonville Transportation Authority. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you, Greer. And we're joined by Shirley Thomas, President of the North Riverside Community Development Corporation. Good morning.
Good morning.
If you have questions or comments about the Emerald Trail, you can reach out at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. Kay Ehouse, what does this federal money mean?
This federal money means we can get the Emerald Trail completed very close to our original timeline.
Which is?
2030.
Okay. I've heard 2029, 2030. 2030 is the new target.
Yeah, 2029 was the original. Now it's 1 year, which isn't bad, 1 year behind. And it's going to be a monumental effort to get it done in that time frame.
This idea has been around since the early 90s under Mayor Ed Austin. You believe, though, that this project and the money that it just got from the federal government will allow for completion?
Yes. Well, think about that. $248 million has already been either spent or secured for segments 1, 2 and the two creeks, and segment 3 for initial design. And so this will complete all of the trail segments. The only thing it will not fund is creek restoration.
Mm-hmm. Which is important. Greer Gillis, what was the federal funding source for this, and why was JTA able to get it?
So the federal funding source was the Reconnecting Communities and the Neighborhood Access and Equity Grant. It's part of the bipartisan infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act. And the JTA was able to get this grant in collaboration with Groundwork Jacksonville and the City of Jacksonville because of our history and our consistency in delivering on projects, major infrastructure projects for the JTA, as well as roadway projects. So U.S. Department of Transportation had a great amount of trust in us to be able to deliver on something like this. But I have to say, Anne, we could not have done this without the support. Congressional delegation, Representative Aaron Bean and John Rutherford, as well as Senators Rick Scott and Marco Rubio, and of course, U.S. Department of Transportation. We could not have done this without all of their support.
And JTA kind of took the lead, as I recall, after you guys reached an agreement with the city and Groundwork Jacks last year that JTA was going to sort of be the funding trajectory for those dollars that you were going to lead that effort.
Correct. City Council, when they passed the local option gas tax, asked us to be responsible for the design, the construction, even the environmental for the five remaining segments. So $132 million came to the JTA for that reason. So because of that, we wanted to make sure that we go after and maximize the use of federal discretionary grants to be able to accelerate the delivery of this program.
Shirley Thomas, you live in one of the neighborhoods that will be part of this 30-mile greenway in North Riverside. What is the mood of the neighborhood there in anticipating this connecting route?
Very, very good. It's a very good mood. We are so happy that Groundwork was able to get this money, and it's a help to the members of the North Riverside. We are an older neighborhood, and the older neighborhood, they need houses, the house repairs. Some of them need their property. Paid for. So that's a great. It's a great thing that we're doing and that they're doing for us.
And what do you think the Greenway, what do people in the community think the Greenway will do in terms of helping the neighborhood in some way?
So far, we think that it will help the neighborhood because they'll have places to go. They have somewhere to go. They have somewhere to walk. Instead of sitting home, they'll have something to do. And it's really going to be a big help. And also with the McCoy Creek, it's going to be restored. And the flooding is going to be done. And it's going to be a great thing. And we still thank so much Groundwork for what they're doing for the neighborhood.
Melissa, what is the city doing in terms of working with neighborhoods like Shirley's to make sure that they're part of the discussion and also that, you know, any repercussions, if there are any, in terms of, you know, displacement are taken care of or anticipated?
Well, let me first say, Anne, that we need to talk a little bit about just how historic this grant is. This is the largest single grant the city of Jacksonville has ever received, $147 million for this landmark project. Now, for those who aren't familiar, the Emerald Trail is going to be a 30-mile trail and linear park system that will connect 14 urban neighborhoods to downtown, Hogan's Creek, McCoy's Creek, and the St. John's River. So it will directly interface with the riverfront activation that the city is also pursuing concurrently. So looking at all of this together, this is a massive infrastructure and climate change mitigation project that's going to stand the city in good stead for decades to come. Picture this green belt linking up nearly two dozen schools, colleges, hospitals, parks, the regional transit center. You know, restaurants, retail, and businesses will now be interconnected. And someone mentioned that this is called reconnecting communities. Well, what the Emerald Trail will do is reconnect communities that were cut off by transportation infrastructure that decimated majority Black neighborhoods decades ago. So you have to think about the Emerald Trail as restorative in that sense. Of course, as we talk about the old JFK saying that success has 1,000 fathers and defeat is an orphan, everybody wants to claim a little bit of the success story behind this. But the simple truth is that everybody collaborated. Mayor Deegan's office collaborated with JTA and Groundwork Jacksonville. We also leveraged the strong relationships we've built with the Biden administration, not to mention the experienced team that we put together to bring more federal tax dollars home. Mayor Deegan was clear about that all throughout her campaign, that the city of Jacksonville was not going after federal grants aggressively enough. So she went after this along with all of our partners, including, of course, the congressional delegation. Back in November of 2023, the mayor, JTA CEO Nat Ford, and Kay Ehas, CEO of Groundwork, went to Washington together to speak to Congressman Rutherford and Bean, as well as the staff of Senator Rubio and Senator Scott and other government officials, to try to land this grant, which is, by the way, an extremely competitive process. So there is so much credit to go around for this really massive win for the city of Jacksonville. Now, to your other question, question about making sure communities aren't left out of the discussion. As many know who followed this administration, Mayor Deegan has made a point of bringing everyone into these conversations. One of the first official acts I did when I was hired to serve this mayor was set up town halls, community conversations in every city council district, which we did last summer, so that we could hear from residents about what was going on in their districts. We created a spreadsheet from those town halls and took questions and concerns to various city departments, and we're still working through those items in that spreadsheet to make sure that we stay in touch with people out in every neighborhood, especially neighborhoods that have been underserved for so long. You know, the mayor likes to say that if she could be known for only one thing after her time in office is done, it's that she fulfilled the broken promises of the city's consolidation 50 plus years ago. And this win for the Emerald Trail is a big, big piece of that. It is going to go a long way toward repairing some of those broken promises, Anne.
Well, let's hear from somebody in the Northside neighborhood. Stanley joins us. Good morning, Stanley. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning to everybody, especially Melissa. My goodness, good people, good people. My main concern here is gentrification, because I am very entrenched in city government, me and John Noonan, my good partner. But my main concern is gentrification. And also, why are we going to wait to make those changes in the underserved community? That's been going on for 54 years. We can talk a good game, but the action behind it, but I do trust Melissa is for doing the right thing under the Deegan administration. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Stanley. The question of gentrification, Kay, what discussions have been had about, you know, making sure that when this trail brings, you know, a resurgence of economic activity or increases property values, that the people who've lived there for a long time in communities that have been traditionally ignored or underfunded, that they're not put out because of that?
Yes, I want to add a couple of things to what Greer said. The other reason this project got funded is because of the project itself, because it is connecting disadvantaged majority Black communities, and because of the way Groundwork Jacksonville has gone about engaging community throughout the entire process from the time we did the master plan, having neighborhoods on that steering committee. So, and this is where Ms. Shirley can talk about this. We are concerned about displacing people. Gentrification isn't always bad. It's displacing people that is the bad thing about gentrification. And so in this grant are funds to create 7 neighborhood plans, working with residents and small businesses around affordable housing and economic development. We believe neighborhoods should be leading their revitalization. And that is our goal, to make that happen. So it also will provide capacity building funds for neighborhood organizations. So it matters to us a great deal that neighborhoods are leading this with us.
Mm-hmm. And Ms. Shirley, what kind of resources would help from your perspective to make sure that people in those surrounding neighborhoods are included and also not pushed out?
Grants. Grants will help with us a lot, because a lot of the people do think that the regentrification, they do think that their houses, their property is going to go up. They think that they're going to be ran out of their houses, and that's what they don't want. Because right now, a lot of us, I'm not getting too many, but a lot of us is getting letters, getting phone calls, and all of this to buy the homes. And some of the people have been in the homes like 30, 40, 60 years, 70 years. And of course, they don't want this to come and take their home, no one to come and take their homes from them, and nor do we. That's why we are telling them not to sell their homes to anyone. Let us know if they've gotten a letter or a phone call about their homes, because that's what older people are concerned about, that they will maybe lose their homes.
Am I allowed to ask a question? And any of you can take this. It's sort of selfish. I noticed that on the map, the trail, when it comes to kind of the area where the Four Seasons Hotel would be, all the way down to this part of the river where the station is located, That there is not an extension of the Riverwalk, that the trail kind of goes up and around and then north. Is there a reason, is there any plan for an extension of the North Bank Riverwalk to include that area, and why isn't the trail part of that?
That's a Melissa Ross question, because the Riverwalk is the city.
Yeah. That is a question that, you know, is a process. Currently we are engaging the public in a series of conversations about riverfront activation. And that is certainly a long-held dream to have the Riverwalk go all the way across. I'll have to get back to you on that one, Anne, because we're in the process of, there are a lot of moving parts when it comes to riverfront stuff right now. Yeah. Why don't you have me back to talk about that at length another time?
All right. After you catch up with Mr. Kahn, we can figure out what the plan is for in front of the Four Seasons. Okay.
So I wanted to add to the gentrification issue, right? We've partnered with LISC and United Way. United Way is putting $10 million towards home preservation, clearing titled property. There's a lot of air properties, so we have to clear title for people so that they can get loans or they can get grants.
And those are properties where people have inherited the property but may not
over
have clear title.
Over generations. And we, right now, we have funds to do home repairs for 47 homes in North Riverside. So there'll be a lot of that. The simplest thing you can do is to keep people in their homes, and how you do that is through home repair. Yeah. That's step number one.
I want to ask about the connectivity thing, because I know that Pete Buttigieg was interviewed here by one of the local TV stations and made a point of saying, you know, this is about bringing, you know, access to disadvantaged communities and connecting them, that was really a consideration in terms of making this award.
Correct. And with the Emerald Trail, then by this award, all the things that Kay and Melissa referenced, we're providing access to jobs, access to healthcare, access to education. And one of the reasons why we are excited about collaborating with the city and groundwork on this is because now we're going to provide access to our services, our fixed route services, our First Coast Flyer, our bus rapid transit line, but also our ultimate urban circulator. You referenced the Riverwalk, and you referenced also the trail coming down to the Riverwalk, where our Phase one, our Bay Street Innovation Corridor, will actually connect with all those things. So we see this as a game changer, providing those seamless mobility solutions for everyone. And I have to say, this was all really the vision of our CEO, Nat Ford. It's because of his leadership, as well as his international and national expertise in being at the table on many of the trade associations as they're talking about infrastructure funding across the gamut. I think we need to also think through that as far as why we were able to successfully bring this amount of money here to Jacksonville. This is a game changer for all of us. And I think we're all, as you can hear, we're very excited and passionate about it.
Yeah. And I've seen that 40% of the trail is complete, under construction, or in design. How much of it is actually done?
Done?
Yeah.
Well, almost done. I mean, so close done, like a month and a half done. Okay. Is the LaVilla Link, which will be 1.3 miles. The shared use path that the FDOT did, that's complete. That's a mile. There's a portion of San Marco that's complete. Coy's Creek is under construction. That's going to be amazing. And the Yes Line Rail Trail is part of it, which is complete as well.
Yeah, McCoy's Creek, it really is going to open up an area that has never really been, a green space. It's been bordered by a road, traditionally had a ton of flooding problems, but it's not been a kind of destination.
And it's no longer flooding.
Yeah.
Since that's under construction. Yeah.
That's huge. And so who is, in terms of like, how do you pick the neighborhoods that are next in line?
Well, I mean, the trail master plan has, you know, an order of which we'll do the trail segments. And there's a method to that madness that the PATH Foundation created. But we're also going to have to figure out how to creatively advance the project over the next 5.5 years.
Sure.
And if I may, Anne, Kay is absolutely right. We said in the grant application we would deliver this by 2034. But now that we have been awarded the funding, we're going to put our minds together to see how we can bring this to the city a lot sooner.
Well, it's very exciting. Thank you all for being here. Kay Ehouse, Greer Gillis, Melissa Ross, and Shirley Thomas, thank you all so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We miss you, Melissa.
We do
miss you guys, too. See you soon.
Up next, how the largest gift in the history of the Community Foundation for Northeast Florida will help local nonprofits meet the challenges ahead. Welcome back. A major donation from Jacksonville philanthropist Dolores Barweaver promises to be a game changer for organizations around the First Coast. Here to talk about the landmark donation and what it means, I'm joined by Isaiah Oliver, president of the Community Foundation for Northeast Florida. Hey, Isaiah.
Good morning.
Good morning. Suzanne Malou, chief of the Jacksonville branch of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Community Foundation Vice President of Programs, Amy Crane. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Ann.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Isaiah, tell us about this $61 million gift from Dolores Weaver, how it came about and its significance.
Well, again, Isaiah Oliver, I often say I lead an organization that's focused on engaging people in the world of philanthropy, this idea of time and talent and treasure and testimony and ties to make communities better places to live in and work in and contribute to. And today, we're talking about not just the financial capital. In philanthropy, we often talk about the financial resources. We're talking about the social, moral, intellectual, and then the, I would say, the reputational capital that donors bring to the table. And so, yes, Ms. Dolores Weaver offered a $61 million gift to support making community a better place. But she's an exceptional leader because she offers all of those capitals to make community better. I think back in 2012, right around the time that she and Wayne sold the Jaguars, they made a significant $50 million gift. At that time, that was the largest gift to the Community Foundation. And just late summer, they made a $61 million gift that is actually our largest gift of all time at the Community Foundation. So we're excited about the gift, but also excited about the time and talent and testimony that she leverages to make community a better place alongside those significant gifts.
And so remind us, the Community Foundation is like a donor-advised fund, which means that the donor gets to control to some extent where those charitable donations are made. They kind of pick their priorities, and then that money goes to those organizations.
So the Community Foundation is a collection of funds. We're a collection of about 700 unique funds, total assets about $650 million. And so we have tons of donors who give significant amounts of money. But donor advised funds are very unique tools that allow donors to be engaged in the grant making process. They make a gift up front, they get the tax deduction up front, and then they make their giving over a period of time.
Right. And so, Suzanne, you're organization is one of the recipients. And it's my understanding that Dolores Barweaver sort of focused her giving in this case on organizations that have proven track records that have shown that they've been able to use funds effectively in the past, including money that she's provided. So I would say that that's a pretty nice recognition in terms of, you know, the work that NAMI does in Jacksonville. What is this money going to be used for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're honored to have Mrs. Weaver trust in our organization to fund our work year after year. We have been fully volunteer run, and her trust in us has moved us from a grassroots organization to an organization that increased our visibility. So people in our community know that we are here for our free mental health support programs that we provide. The mission of NAMI Jacksonville is to support and improve the quality of life for individuals and family members, individuals who live with mental illness, and family members who are caring for their loved ones. And the heart of our work is engaging volunteers and to provide peer-to-peer support to these individuals and to families separately. And Mrs. Weaver has really been one of our first strategic funders. And while she is strategic in her funding, she has really trusted us that we have our finger on the pulse of mental health in our community and given us the opportunity to use that funding in the places where we feel that it will serve our community the most.
Mm-hmm. And Amy, talk about some of that strategic funding from Ms. Weaver. You know, she seems to have focused on women's issues to a large extent, health, mental health. Talk about how she has chosen to invest. I know that you can't tell us all of the places that she's invested in for privacy reasons.
Well, yes, and we feel like that good news is the good news of the organizations that she is working with at this time. And so while we're really excited about announcing the gift, and in fact, I'd like to just tell everyone that she calls it her labor of love, because it really is a gift to Northeast Florida, and the gift extends beyond Northeast Florida to regional organizations and international organizations and national organizations. So using Suzanne's word, it has been really strategic. She is working with organizations that she has a track record with, and she's also looking into sectors that she really feels strongly about. So you mentioned a few, and I'll say, too, that the domestic violence shelters, for example, she funded all of them regionally with this gift. She's looked deep into the environment here in Jacksonville, and she's made gifts to organizations like the Riverkeeper, the Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens, to the Riverkeeper. And so this at North Florida Land Trust, that's who I was just thinking about. And so again, this broad base of work, it's even extended into arts and culture, Anne, and that's why at the Community Foundation, we feel, she really sees the nonprofits as her hands in doing this work. And then we are there to help her to be able to, again, make those investments in the community.
And Isaiah, some of this money is, it's going to help organizations, provide their services. But a aim of it is to make sure that they have some financial security and stability years and years into the future.
Yes. And so she told us that coming to do the work at the Community Foundation and partnering with the Community Foundation was going to allow her to do more. And we are sure that that's going to happen. One, a $61 million gift into her donor advice fund, which she'll give out over time. She's also done a lot of work to make sure that she's building the capacity of nonprofits, not only today, but moving forward. And so we're excited about doing this work in partnership with her. And we'll continue to show, because our Community Foundation leaders, if you will, the staff of the Community Foundation have a really good understanding of the pulse of community, the nonprofit community, and the other donors that might partner with Dolores in doing some of this incredible work.
And does a gift like that inspire others to give? Is it kind of an effect on other large givers and donors that might consider making?
Again, we're very proud to partner with Dolores and her philanthropy, because she is a pace-setting philanthropist in Northeast Florida. We would say that she's almost an exemplar in lots of ways. Again, significant amount of gifts, but also leveraging all of the other capitals that she brings to the table. She's inside. She's learning alongside us. She's helping us with the grant-making process. We're managing the back office. We're making sure that we're managing the relationships and the grants going out. But she is essentially part of the grant-making process. And the incredible work that she's doing right now is, again, a model for how philanthropy should happen in this town.
And what sets her apart, the way that her style, her approach, from perhaps other philanthropic, individuals?
I would actually throw that to Amy.
I think that it's extraordinary that Mrs. Weaver is such a hard worker. And we'll hear from her, every day over the weekend. This is her work and this is her passion. I would say, too, that Mrs. Weaver's capacity to be able to understand Northeast Florida is, without par, because, we kind of joke as a team that, we use a lot of spreadsheets and we might be examining things carefully. And Mrs. Weaver just recalls all of the gifts and all of the work and all of the leaders like Suzanne and others. And she's really invested herself 100%. And it's extraordinary.
And the money that she, has is partly, her husband and her owned the Jaguars, but they were self-made in their, wealth, right? They started with a shoe company.
That's right. And they worked side by side. And Mrs. Weaver tells terrific stories about when they were younger and working in her parents' store. And they are people who have truly found their own passion in their work, and then were able to then bless the community. They prioritized blessing the community where they relocated when they came with the Jaguars.
And Suzanne, how does an organization like yours connect with somebody like Dolores Barr Weaver and make an impression on her? How do you pitch, I guess?
Yeah, as we were growing in our organization, through the Community Foundation, which has been an incredible relationship for us as well, is that we began to work with Mrs. Weaver and she learned what we were doing. We were fortunate to have a gift back in 2019, which was a fund created by Mrs. Weaver called the Partnership for Mental Health. And we were a recipient of that funding back in 19 that helped us grow our helpline so that we can respond to 988 calls, the new 988 system that's coming in. And as she learns what we're doing and we continue to show that we are great stewards of that money and that we're really infusing that into our community and helping individuals. We help individuals, family members who call 988 and they come to NAMI Jacksonville so we can help guide them. And she can see that we're really touching individuals. And so we've now gained that trust and she's now granted us another 5-year grant to provide a staff member to actually sit and answer those calls for family members.
And for people who may not remember or even know, remind us what the 988 is, what purpose that serves.
It's a new crisis and suicide lifeline that is a 3-digit number that replaces the suicide lifeline number. And it's a 3-digit easy number that was federally mandated. And it was really an opportunity to have a behavioral health response to a behavioral health crisis and remove it from the criminal justice system. And so while those calls come into 988 nationally, the ground level here in our community is building a way to sustain and respond to those calls and provide our assistance after people call and become de-escalated and help them navigate further help.
And so that must be a pretty significant new workload with that 988 number, which I'm sure is a challenge, but also a great thing, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we've had a helpline for 35 years, but to have the opportunity for people to understand they can call 988 and they can actually reach many crisis callers, but also reach other community providers, including NAMI Jacksonville.
Isaiah, other than this donation, is this a catalyst for others? This happened last summer, right? So are you seeing any sort of wealth generation donations building on this really large donation?
I believe so. I believe, but I also believe this story and the way that she gives is going to be a catalyst for others. Dolores loves this story of the starfish on the beach, where there's a little boy and he's picking them up one by one and tossing them back into the ocean. And while this little boy knows that he can't address all of the problems, he can't fix all of the problems for every starfish, he knows that one by one, he's fixing the problem for that one. And that exemplifies her approach to philanthropy. And I think that is going to be the thing that's going to change the way we do philanthropy in this town.
But that takes some wherewithal and some resilience, you know, to pick up those starfish when there's a beach full of them. How does that metaphor work for the work that you do at the Community Foundation? I mean, there's a lot of starfish out there.
There are a lot of starfish, and I'll say that Mrs. Weaver's pretty well known for challenge gifts, and I think that that's something also that goes back to her days. She's told the story to us, and we honor it. She says that there were a lot of times when she and Wayne did not have money to be able to give in such a large way, but that they were never asked. And so Mrs. Weaver offers the challenges to the community because she believes that everybody has some capacity to give, and all people need to do is be asked. And so I think that that's why she structured her work that way. It is really strategic. And I like the way that you said that, because it does stimulate other people in our community to think of themselves in the same way that she sees herself as a philanthropist.
Well, thank you, Isaiah Oliver, Amy Crane, and Suzanne Maylou for being here and telling us about this big donation. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
And stick around in just a minute. Our own Dan Scanlon gives us a chauffeured tour of the latest automotive news.
UF Health Jacksonville works every day to innovate, inspire, and impact the health of the entire community. That's because their care never quits. Discover how at ufhealthjacks.org/neverquit.
So, you've never donated to this station before? That's okay. Public Media Giving Days are a great time to make your first gift. Here's how.
Please visit wjct.org/radio, and thank you. On the next Fresh Air, NPR political correspondent Sarah McCammon talks about growing up in and leaving the white evangelical church. Her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, is part memoir and part reporting. It's also about the influence evangelical Christians have on the political right. McCammon covered the 2016 Trump campaign for NPR. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The results from Russia's presidential election, Vladimir Putin is expected to win his sixth term in power. The country's still at war in Ukraine, dissidents are silenced or killed, and sanctions have not crippled Russia's economy. What's next for Russia and all the day's global news? That's next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Those elections were so safe for the incumbents a lot of times that they really didn't have to engage voters in a way that you normally would in an election.
Competitive elections protect democracy. Alabama has few of them, but they're trying to change that. Next time on 1A, we're back in Birmingham looking at election maps, the state of our democracy, and trust in our government.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. The news about electric vehicles remains a hard charging headline, and I'm pleased to welcome back WJCT reporter and automobile superfan Dan Scanlon to discuss the bumpy road ahead for EV manufacturers. Hey, Dan.
Hi there. Well, you know, the bottom line is the Amelia Island Concours was 2 weeks ago, and other than a Ferrari and a McLaren, those are gas-powered supercars, almost every new car preview was an electric vehicle.
I'm going to let you talk about that, but you won an award. I want to hear about it. You won an award at the Concours.
I got a Concours de Lemons award for my Alfa Romeo as the most badly sophisticated Italian car. It was the only Italian car at the Lemons show, so what the heck, but I love it.
Well, congrats. Thanks. At any rate, there was only two regular powered vehicles.
But basically everything else was electric. The Chrysler Halcyon, which is a killer looking concept, was there. Karma showed off some stuff that, and then a few days later opened the 22nd in the U.S. Karma dealership on Beach Boulevard. I got to drive one of the new Lucid Airs, and they are stunning sedans. They drive beautifully. They're quiet. They're luxurious. And the one I drove was $69,000, which is cheap for a luxury electric. That said, Karma was started by Henrik Fisker. Henrik Fisker's went bankrupt, so a Chinese group bought Karma. Now Henrik Fisker's new vehicle, the Ocean, and his new Fisker electric is filing for bankruptcy, according to sources. He released a statement saying, basically, we're doing what we need to do to survive, so we don't know.
You say Fisker. Are we supposed to know who he is?
Henrik Fisker designed a lot of really cool BMWs and a lot of cool Mercedes-Benzes, and then went into his own business, designed some really cool stuff. But he has a track record now of two electric car companies under him going belly up. That said, his Karma, his first one, actually has survived and appears to be doing well. We've got the new dealership on Beach Boulevard.
Good Karma.
But good Karma, yes. That said, also, it looks like the bloom is off the rose when it comes to electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. The early adopters have gone out there and bought their electrics. We have a few in this parking lot. But now car makers seem to be backing off of making electric cars. We're hearing that some of the companies are backing off on the plans to go all electric. And that includes Ford, General Motors, Mercedes-Benz, Volkswagen. Mercedes is restyling their electric cars to look a little more like a Mercedes and less like a jelly bean, we hear. Ford has done some backing off. Even Tesla has shown that there's a noticeably lower rate of growth.
Well, let's talk about some pollution concerns, because obviously a lot of what's driving this revolution is climate change and the need to deal with our carbon footprint. But these are not free of pollution entirely.
Apparently, a 2022 study has resurfaced in a lot of media that says that because of the heavier weight of an electric, they are actually burning up their tires. There's particulate matter coming off of tires. So that's the pollution issue with an electric car. And then, as everybody I talk to says, yeah, what happens overnight when everybody starts plugging in their cars and you're normally very quiet electric companies and their generators have to start bulking them up. And so there's more power being generated at night. So it's a toss-up. I tell you, that Lucid was a lovely sedan. Every electric car I've tested is lovely, quick, 250 miles range. That could get me to and from work for a few days without worrying about charging. But there are issues, and the early adopters have bought them. The bloom is off that rose. Now we settle in, and we have to take a longer look at electrics versus gas hybrids, et cetera.
And, I mean, some of these really are incredible looking. I saw some pictures. Is it the Gazera? It's got, like, these scissor doors, and it's a sports coupe.
It's an 1,100-horsepower electric car that they had at that they have at the dealership or had it there on Beach Boulevard. And then their new Gazera, I believe, which is the sedan, which is the original Karma design, is stunning. Every line is perfect. It's got room for four. It's got a 300-mile range. It's a really beautiful, hyper-luxury electric performance sedan. And I wish them the best of luck because that car will stand out in the crowd. It won't be a jelly bean. It will be what you want, what I want in an electric, which is a performer that also fits people and is also efficient. With 300 miles plus range, that's a game changer. But again, they're only going to sell a few hundred. The dealership is going to be going into other things. The dealer owner told me he's going to be getting some really exciting news soon. He intends to have a large chunk of that property dedicated in 5 years to various car brands and marks. I think that's going to be a pretty cool business bump for that stretch of Beach Boulevard near 295.
So you say the bloom is off the rose. Is demand slowing? Is that the main thing? Or were consumer forecasts inaccurate?
Well, demand is slowing. The people who wanted them, who desperately wanted an EV, have bought them now. And you're seeing more of them around there. But I think what I'm seeing is now that you and I, who might be considering a new car, might not be in the EV ballpark yet. We have to see a little difference. We have to see our better charging network, more reliability when Tesla superchargers become available to other car makers because of interchangeable adapters. Then we will see a supercharger, a plug-in network for cars all over. I mean, there are so many Tesla superchargers within biking distance of where we're sitting right now. It's not funny, but right now only Teslas and a few cars that have adapters can use them. In a year or two, when the Fords and the other companies start getting those adapters and they can use the supercharger, you can travel across the country without breaking a sweat because you'll have a supercharger or somebody else's charger nearby.
Well, Dan Scanlon, I always appreciate your insights on all things automotive, which is an area I just don't know much about, but I always learn something from you. So thank you for being on.
Hey, gas it up.
All right. And that's our program. We encourage your feedback or suggestions for future segments. You can send both to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock or find our entire archive at WJCT.org or on your favorite podcast platform. The executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our producer is Stacey Bennett. Kathy Waterman is our associate producer, and our director is Brady Corum. Join us Tuesday when ethics advocates explain why they want the governor to veto a bill they say will gut anti-corruption efforts. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.